Well, good morning. May grace and peace be multiplied to each one this morning. On March 11th, 2011, at 2:46 in the afternoon, Japan was struck with a magnitude 9.0 earthquake. It was centered out in the Pacific Ocean, about 50 miles from the coast. And it set a powerful tsunami into action. They estimate the waves actually reached up to 133 feet. Can you imagine that? A wave coming into your town at 133 feet tall. They said it was the largest recorded earthquake ever recorded in Japan, and it was the fourth largest ever recorded worldwide since 1900. On the coast was the Fukushima nuclear power plant. They say three of the six reactors were in operation at the time. And when the earthquake took place, there was an automated process. They call it SCRAM. And SCRAM, what happens with SCRAM is they have these control rods, and they insert them in between the reactor fuel rods, and it suppresses and stops the nuclear reaction. Now, we talked a little bit about nuclear yesterday, and you know they take uranium and they bombard it with neutrons, and it starts a process. It breaks the atoms up, and more neutrons are released, and it just keeps this chain reaction going, breaking up more and more. And that's what nuclear bombs are actually, how they destroy so many people with such a small thing is because of a nuclear reaction. Well, these control rods, they're made out of a substance called boron, and somehow they figured out boron absorbs neutrons. So they can stick these control rods into the reactor and stop the nuclear fission and the reaction going immediately. And it comes to a halt. Yesterday we were talking about God's grace, and we were likening it to this little pellet the size of this big right here, actually. And we said that it could power your home for 2.5 months. And we likened grace to the New Testament's new marvel, the Holy Spirit in our lives, and the power that's given. It was something new. We read the verse, grace and truth came by Jesus. The law came by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus. Now let's see if anybody remembers, or maybe you can look back in your books from yesterday. But we'll just write grace up here. What can we remember for some of the facets? You think of a diamond and all the different facets of a diamond. What were some of the facets we learned grace was? Anybody? Okay, so we'll put power. What else did we learn?
Teaches us.
Teaches. Yep, teaches. What else did we learn?
Chastens,
okay. Yep, we'll put that right here. That's actually another definition of the word of grace. And it translated another place in the Bible. What else did we learn? Any from this side? Okay, it teaches us to do that. What was the, okay, so we had power. We had, it teaches us to deny ungodliness. Do you remember we had, I'll help out here, and we had helper. What else?
Labor,
yes. And supplies. So these are facets that grace does in our lives. And we use the Bible to define that. We didn't use just what the modern day commentators use. We use the Bible just like we would look at a $100 bill to figure out if it's counterfeit or not. We use the Bible to figure that out. We learned that the Strong's definition was God's divine influence on the heart and reflection in the life, just like a mirror reflects as God influences our hearts. So I want to continue talking about this. How many of you would like to experience that in your daily life? Looks like nobody's not putting their hand up, so that's a good thing. Let's go to James chapter 4 this morning. James chapter 4. I want to ask the question, if boron can be inserted into a nuclear reaction and stop the nuclear fission from happening, is there something in our lives that can stop grace from happening? In James chapter 4 and verse 6, I believe this answers the question. James tells us, but he, speaking of God, giveth more grace, wherefore he saith, God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. The title of today's sermon is just simply, God gives grace to the humble. Now, we just read this word, resist. I looked this word up in the Greek lexicon, and it was a little shocking what I read as some of the definitions of this Greek word for resist. God resists the proud. You know, one of the definitions I read was God ranges in battle against you. That was one of the words for the word resist. Like, if you could imagine somebody setting up a fleet of military officers to resist another force, that's the word that was used, that James, and by the way, Apostle Peter chose to use. God resists. He holds back against. He opposes. He ranges in battle against us when we're proud. That means that there's two sides to God. There's a side that wants to help you, that favors you, as we've heard the definition, unmerited favor. He teaches us, he helps us, he labors. But then there's a side of God that resists us. And what's amazing about this is it's our choice what side of God we get. If you stop and think about that. So here's the question. We read, yes, sir, are there people that, all these quotes, so there's no conditions, you know, no strings attached to God's grace. Now, if we're just going to take the Bible, are there conditions for God's grace? What's the condition here? What is the condition? Humility. I'm going to do an illustration here. I'm going to give away $10 to anybody that's from the state of Alaska. Anybody here from Alaska? Oh, nobody. Okay. I'm going to give $10 from anyone who is here from the state of Vermont. Anybody here from the state of Vermont? Okay. Anybody else from Vermont? I see a hand back there. Okay, you get $10. Thank you, sir. Yes, you're welcome. Spend it on something good, like feeding poor people. Oh, no guilt trips. Here, pass this down to her. Thank you. Now, did they earn that $10? Did he do anything to earn it? No. Was it free? Yep, it was free. Was it unmerited? Did he do something special? Did I pick him because of a certain thing, you know? Because, you know, he merited it? But was there a condition? Did any of you get it? No, because you didn't meet the condition, did you? Now, if I would have gone over there and said, if he wouldn't have raised his hand, hey, whoever is from the state of Vermont, if he wouldn't have raised his hand, he wouldn't have received it either. See, he had to meet the condition. It wasn't that he merited it. It wasn't that it wasn't free, but he had to meet a condition. And in the same way, this very much helped me. Years ago, when I was a Baptist, struggling with the idea of grace and unmerited favor, I remember reading David Brousseau's book, who's here this weekend, and he said, if a king said, bring me a basket of apples, I'll give you half of my kingdom. And somebody brought him a basket of apples. Did he earn half the kingdom? No. Did he merit half the kingdom? No. But was there a condition? Yes. Grace has conditions. God's grace in our lives. The grace that saves us has conditions. You have to repent. You have to believe. The grace that continues to save you, you have to humble yourself. And it's your choice. It's just like pride. It's just like that boron. It will stop the nuclear reaction. Pride in our hearts will stop God's grace from flowing in our lives. It not only stops, but as we read in that lexicon dictionary, he even opposes us. He works against us. Now, here's a definition of pride from the Webster's 1828 dictionary. It says, pride means inordinate, and that's an old English word for excessive, self-esteem. an unreasonable conceit of one's own superiority in talents, beauty, wealth, accomplishments, rank, or elevation in office. And this is how it manifests itself. It manifests itself in lofty airs. You know, you walk around just with that little bit of a lofty look. Distance, you know, you're a little too low for me. I don't think I'll hang out with you because you're not cool. Reserve, and often in contempt of others. That's the definition of pride. And you know what the thing about pride is? It's pretty deceptive. Isn't it so much easier to see pride in somebody else than it is to see in our own selves? Yeah, it seems to just stick out like a sore thumb when other people have pride. But pride essentially removes God off the throne in our hearts and puts ourselves on it instead. And instead of recognizing that it was grace that we even stand, it's grace that we're even here, it's grace that even God called us and that he loved us, we think we earned it and we're in control. I remember when my children were little, they would come in and say, "Oh, Papa, come out and look at this. It's so great. You know, I did this great jump, and I jumped this high on this bike, and I built this jump." And they get a little bit too excited about how good they did. And I just remind them, you know, you could have woken up this morning with a mental illness. You could have woken up this morning like as a cripple. You should thank God that he gave you muscles, that he gave you strength, that he gave you the ability to do this. Yes, you did a great job, but sometimes we just need to remind it. It's because of God that we even stand here. And you know, pride is kind of like I heard a preacher say once, it's kind of like an onion. We deal with it, and then there's another layer. And we deal with that, and then there's another layer. And it just, it goes, I think honestly, for the rest of our lives, we're going to be going deeper and deeper on that onion, but at least we're eliminating. First, we start off with the big things, and it gets smaller and smaller. There's lots of ways we can be made. We can have pride. We just read the definition. But I heard a preacher say once, "What is the secret to the Christian life?" We're talking about the inner Christian life. Now, here was his key. Here was his secret. You ready to write it down? The first key, humility. Everybody, write that down. Real good. What's the second key? Humility. And what's the third key? Humility. The secret to the Christian life is humility. But what I want to focus on today, we could talk about, you know, I remember years ago hearing David Cooper preach on, is it a sin to be cool? We could talk about that, and that's a good sermon. You should listen to it. But I want to talk about something a little more practical, a little more everyday, you know, when you're by yourself and you're not thinking about your friend. You're not thinking about being cool necessarily, but you're by yourself and you have this thing deep in your heart and it's called your will. It's called your way and what God wants to do with pride. Pride against God. Not, yes, we need to work with pride with men, but you know, pride is first an attitude of independence from God. And it's directly opposed to a humble and a lowly and a godly and a trusting, faith-filled person who is pleasing to God. Listen to this quote, this thing I read. It says, "Pride is a state of mind, a condition of the heart in which a person has replaced the rule of God over his life with the rule of his own will." And instead of depending entirely on God, as was God's design, a proud heart now looks to itself to decide what is good and what is evil. And this is exactly what happened with Adam and Eve when they fell in the garden. Think about that story. God created the garden. He put man and woman there. And he said, "You may eat of any tree, including the tree of life that would continue to give them life." But he said, "I don't want you to eat from this one tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil." And the serpent came along and he questioned. He said, "You know, yea, hath God said." He said, "You know, God doesn't want you to eat that, but he has bad motives." And Your eyes will be opened and you'll be like gods if you eat of the tree. And they did eat of the tree. And what did God say when they ate of that tree of the knowledge of good and evil? It says, the man has become as one of us to know good and evil. Something changed. When they ate of that tree, they were no longer dependent on God. They now had, we realize in the story, they now knew they were naked. They somehow, and I can't explain it, but something changed where their independence of relying on God for good and evil had changed. And God said, they can't eat of the tree of life anymore because if they become independent of me. They were able somehow to distinguish right and wrong on their own without God. And that has been our struggle ever since. I remember years ago growing up with my father-in-law's church, and he would quote this verse out of Psalms. It says, the wicked, through the pride of his countenance, will not seek after God. God is not in all of his thoughts. I wonder, you know, think about your day. Think about the waking hours you have. How many times a day does God come into your thoughts? How many times a day are you acknowledging him in what you're doing? Or if you're like me, and it's so prone in our flesh to do, is it more like we get up, acknowledge God, and then we just go on with our day? So I want to look at that, an attitude of independence from God. I saw this somewhere. It was very convicting. An attitude of independence from God. You might say, well, I don't really have that. An attitude of independence from God? I don't have that. Well, listen to this. What this person says, question, do you pray regularly? You might say, well, I don't pray as much as I should. You don't pray because you don't feel the need to. You think, I can handle it. If you are wrestling with prayerlessness, you are really wrestling with pride. That just hit me. Wow. When we wrestle with prayerlessness, it's because we don't see our need. We don't see that we need God. So I want to use this illustration here. So grace is kind of like this water in a bottle. When I lower one side, whatever is the lowest side, the water goes to. Right? Whatever's the lowest side. And this is a law in God's world. As we humble ourselves, the promise is that grace is given. As we decide not to humble ourselves, the grace is going to be taken away. In fact, Peter told us this. He said, be clothed with humility. When you get up in the morning and you pick out your clothes, in the same way in the spirit, you're supposed to be thinking, I'm putting on the clothes of humility. I want to tell you about some horses. I want to tell you about the Greeks and how they selected horses. Now, the Greeks, they would go up in the mountains, and they would look for these horses that they could find. They were wild, wild horses. And they would bring them down to the mountains, and they would work with them. They would train them. Remember this word, chasten? They would train them. They would try to get them to submit. They'd try to break their will. I remember, this just came to me. I remember when we lived in Belize, my son tried to break horses. And I mean, he would take the horses and this is what the old order people taught them down there, tie their legs up to like all to their body and put them on the ground. And I watched that horse be broken. And he did. He broke those horses, but quite a process. And the Greeks would train these horses. And after a couple of months, they would start deciding, how good are these horses? Some of them just stayed wild. You know, they would not submit. They would not be broken. And so they just had to discard them. They couldn't use those horses. Some of them were used for just ordinary duties, but they still had too much of their own temperament in there and too much will. And some of them became war horses. These were the elite horses. These horses were broken. They could be taken into war. They could thunder into battle and with all of the sound and all of the noise stop when their rider said to stop, with a whisper, with a small touch. And you know what they called this horse? The one that was ready for war, the one that was broken? They use the Greek word praus. And that is the same word in your Bible as meek. Meek means humble. Meek means lowly. Think about that. When they could get the horse to be able to go into war at its rider's command, it was considered meek. It was considered humble. And I wonder sometimes which one we are. You know, they didn't lose that courage or that personality to still go, but they had power under control. They had strength under authority. We learned it yesterday. The grace of God teaches us. So I want you all to take your books now, and I want you to think of something in the last 10 days or so. I want you, yesterday you wrote something that was something you would like help in. But I want you to think of something ordinary that was hard. It just could have been a frustration in your day. Could have been something that made you stressed out, something that you got anxious about. Maybe it was a trial, a difficulty. But think of something. I'm going to give you a minute here. Please think of something and write it down. Maybe some of you will think of nothing, and I should have you up here. Because in the last 10 days, I can tell you something. I'll tell you in a minute that happened to me. When you're done, you can look up here, and then I'll know when the most of you are done. Okay. Now, I want you to imagine your average day. You wake up, you know, you have your devotions, your prayer time, at least I hope you do, and you step away from those devotions, and the rest of the day, who is it more about? Whose will is it more about? Remember what Jesus said? We had that little picture up here yesterday. He said, I can of mine own self do nothing. He said, but as I hear, I judge. And my judgment is just because what? He doesn't seek his own will, he said, but of the will of the one that sent me. Now, I ask this question. Which horse do you think Jesus was more like? Was he more like this horse or this horse? One way I think we can tell where we're at is the way we react to trials and situations in our life. When it doesn't turn out like you expected, we tend to get frustrated. We tend to grumble. We tend to complain. We might pound our hand against something. We might speak harshly. Which horse is that closer to? Is it possible we still have this substance like boron that stops the nuclear reaction? Is it possible we still have this substance in our hearts called pride? That's an independence from God. Is it possible that God is still trying to break us? I want you all to turn to Matthew chapter 11. Matthew 11 and verse 28. Jesus said in this verse, he said, come unto me, Matthew 11, verse 28, come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest for your souls. Now, a lot of times we might take this for extreme circumstances, but my question is, he goes on and he says here, all of you who are laboring and that are heavy laden, this means that you're weary, you're tired, you're exhausted. Maybe you're struggling with sin. Maybe you're struggling with temptations. Maybe you're struggling with stress and anxiety in your life. Or he says, are laden, loaded up, or overloaded. He says, now the answer to that is to take something. That's a choice of your own. It's not him forcing it on you. You get to decide to take his yoke upon you. Now, think about a yoke. What do you think a yoke is good for? What's the first thing you think as you think a yoke? Why would I put a yoke on something? I got one ox. I put a yoke on. Why? Were you going to say something? Nope. What was it? Sorry. To harness its power and to distribute it with another horse, right? A yoke puts it over to the next horse. So now, or ox, now I don't have to work so hard on my own. I can distribute the weight. But there is also something else with a yoke. When I put a yoke on, I lose my personal freedom. I can't do it my way, right? A yoke, it helps me carry the load, but a yoke also keeps me there in that place. A yoke also means I have work to do. We need to do work for God. We need to accomplish things. We need to accomplish righteousness, as we wrote on the board yesterday. So a yoke spreads out the effort, but a yoke also is opposite to my personal freedom. And Jesus says to learn of him. So we're in school with Jesus as we're along with this yoke. We're learning from him. He doesn't tell you he's going to teach you more Bible knowledge. He tells you he's going to teach you meekness and lowliness. He said, learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart. Not on Sunday mornings, but on Monday when you're at work and when you're wherever you are, whatever task you're doing. He wants you to learn lowliness in heart. I remember, like I told you yesterday, for the first 7 years, I became under the fear of God, and I wanted to obey Jesus' teachings, and I wanted to do everything he said. But what does it all mean? I mean, deny yourself, take up your cross, sell everything you have. What am I supposed to do? And especially this idea of deny yourself. I knew some brothers, you know, they would deny themselves very ascetically. And I was struggling with this meaning of what does it mean to deny yourself? And it for sure means to deny ungodliness and worldly lust, as we learn in Titus. But another thing a brother told me it means, to deny yourself, your will. He said it very simply. He said, one way I've learned to deny myself is to accept the situation. Accept the situation. What does that mean? Well, he said, you know, you go along your day and you make all your plans in the morning. You know, we're going to go here. We're going to stop at this store. We're going to go over there. And you start going, and what happens? Inevitably, something goes wrong. You know, if you're a parent, it's the children that seem to make you late. You know, if you're by yourself, if it's one of you, you aren't parents yet, it's probably, you know, the vehicle doesn't work right, can't find your phone, you lose your wallet, and pretty soon, you know, you're starting to get frustrated, right? Your day's not going like you planned it. What things did you write down? Somebody give me an example. What you wrote in your book. What happened the last 10 days that was something that I'm talking about right now that just messed up your plans or was really a struggle? Anybody going to be brave? Yes. Flat tire right before you're ready to leave. Exactly. Somebody else going to be brave? Yes. Taking out the trash, that's annoying, right? Right? Okay, I'll tell you a quick story. As we were coming here, I had so many stresses going on. My mom has schizophrenia. The night before we were leaving, she started deciding she was moving out of the house. And I'm starting to think, are we even moving? Are we even going to be able to go? And so I'm trying to let this go. You know, this is God's thing. And then the next day we get up and we're like, okay, we're heading out. We're going to get on this plane. We're up at 3 a.m. We get down and everything's good. Everything's going as planned. We walk in to the airport, look out the window, and it's snowing in Oregon. That doesn't happen that often. And oh, I didn't think twice about it. We got on the plane, and the pilot, and by the way, we had a 45-minute connection flight over down in Phoenix. And this is when you have too much information, then it stresses you out. But I'd read that there was this 7 o'clock ice storm coming into Pennsylvania, and if we wanted to cancel all our tickets, we could, and just change it for another time, how could I do that? But anyway, so I'm thinking about this 7 o'clock ice storm coming. We have a 45-minute connection time, and we get in the plane, and the pilot says, oh, folks, we're going to have to de-ice. And we're second in line. And in Eugene, they're not prepared. They don't have these big water cannon trucks. They're a little like, looks like squirt guns out there trying to spray the plane down. And it was taking so long to get this thing sprayed down. And I think it was 30 minutes, and we're number two. And then he comes on, the pilot comes on, sorry, folks, we're now number three. And, you know, I'm sure you two weren't stressing out, but I was trying not to stress out because I'm responsible for nine other people on this plane, and I was having visions of when we had just come back from Belize just 3 months earlier and got stuck, all 10 of us, in the air, in Dallas for 2 days. And so I'm thinking, this is not going as planned, and we're going to miss our 45. And then, so now we're at 45 minutes, and okay, we're finally almost done de-icing, and then he comes on, oh, another plane pulled out in our way. We're going to have to wait for him. And I'm thinking, we are going to miss the flight. And so I'm trying to accept the situation. I'm trying to say, okay, Lord, this is not your thing. I mean, I didn't call myself to preach at this Bible school. Somebody else called me, so this is you. And I was trying to let it go and trust God through it. And so, sure enough, we got down there. We had 15 minutes to get to the next flight. So we're all running, trying, and some of them are running ahead of us, and they get over there, and they said right as they got to the gate, the plane's pulling away. And, you know, we have 9, 10 of us trying to get on the next flight. What is the likelihood that's ever going to happen? So we're thinking, how are we going to get some there, and who should go first, and maybe some of us just go back, take care of my mom or something. And so we go to the customer service desk, and you know what they tell us? Oh, yeah, we have room on the next flight for all 10 of you. And I got to sit by my wife. Couldn't believe it. I should have had more faith. But anyway, they got us on the plane. We flew. We made up a whole extra time, hour time. We only were an hour late. And Dennis said that all the other flights out of Phoenix were canceled because of the ice storm. So we just barely made it in. That was one of the situations just a couple of days for me. And I'm sure all of you experience things like that, especially when you fly. That tense feeling we get in our chest when something is not going like we want. And what is our natural response is to grumble and to complain. Think things like, I have so much to do. I didn't need this. We become short. You know, it says, love is patient. Love is kind. And when we're in a hurry and we're rushed and we're stressed, we're not kind. We're not patient. And so in those moments, stop and ask yourself, and this is what I have to do. This is what I had to do to start learning this. I had to learn the grace of God was starting to teach me to humble myself and to say, God, I'm not in control. I can't change this. You know, there's that prayer. I'll try to quote it right now, but it says, God, give me the grace and serenity to accept the things I cannot change and to have courage in the things I can change and have wisdom to know the difference. And that's what we need. We need the grace and peace to accept the things that come into our lives that we cannot change. And if we're really honest, we're probably not even thinking about God in those situations, right? I mean, when you're in your most stressful moment, are you thinking about God? Like where was the guy that raised his hand that got the flat tire? Was your first thought God? No. You're thinking me, right? Why me? This car. And that's a problem. Do you think that's how Jesus thought when he was in trials and tribulations and hardships? He said, without the Father, I can do nothing. I think if we're really honest, this is an area of pride in our life. And it's a hidden pride. You know, we think of pride, like I said, when it comes to others. We're not really walking in that verse. Trust in the Lord with all of your heart. You know, if we're really walking with God, we would wake up in the morning and say, in all your ways, acknowledge him. Lord, I acknowledge you. Here's my plans for the day. This, 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 and this. But Lord, you change them around how you will. You direct me how you will. It says, in all your ways and acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths. That's true. That's true walking in the Spirit. That's true having the inner Christian life. And the promise is when we do that, when we humble ourselves, he gives us grace to overcome sin. I'm going to tell you a story about when I lived in Belize. I call it the zucchini story. How many of you like zucchini? Wow, I thought I'd see less hands. Well, I was diagnosed with cancer, and I thought this would be a good idea to move to Belize. You know, this is our last, maybe I was going to die, and so this would be a good time to do something with my family. So we moved to Belize, and in Belize, you know, when you have cancer, by the way, you think all of a sudden very healthfully. You know, I need to eat lots of vegetables, not just burgers and fries and things. So we moved to Belize, and in Belize, they don't have vegetables like we can just run down to the store here. You've got to go to the market, the vegetable market, to find zucchini, and you have to go on only 2 days a week, and you have to go early, or else the zucchini somehow gets all bought up. And so we'd go to the market, and I'd try to get my children up. I had five of them. They didn't want to go for zucchini. Why would they want to go to the market for zucchini? And so I would try to get them out of bed and try to get them going, and it was like everything would go wrong, and we'd get to the market, and there'd be no zucchini. And what would happen? Of course, I'd start speaking to them rude and harsh, and don't you know I need zucchini to live? And it wouldn't happen. And I had to start to learn, right during this time, the Lord was teaching me this whole concept that I'm trying to teach right now. The concept of humbling ourselves. And I had to start saying, Lord, this is your thing. You're in control of my health. And I had to start just accepting the situation. I tried to train my children better, and I did my part. But at the end of the day, I had to learn that I need to go places in peace. I need to go places trusting God. So what I want to do here, we wrote grace. We wrote these different facets of what grace is. I want to write the first, and tomorrow we'll write the second. But the first thing we're going to write here on the process of receiving grace, the condition we need to be in, is humility. We need to be in the condition of humility. And this first takes seeing our need. Do we see ourselves as poor and needy? In the Old Testament, the same verse, God gives grace to the lowly. That Hebrew word means poor, needy, weak, meek. Do we see ourselves as poor and needy? That's pretty hard to see ourselves as poor and needy, honestly. But Jesus said, I am the vine and you are the branches. And he said that he that abides in me, the same brings forth much fruit. He says, without me, you can do nothing. I remember when that verse, when I was actually at somebody's house and they had a little plaque on the wall that said that, and it just clicked in my heart. Without me, you can do nothing. You can do zero without Christ. I have a little illustration here. I need 7 volunteers, and I'd like some from the guys and some from the girls. And I'd like you to come stand right here, 7 of you. Wow. Yeah, just come on up. Okay, not all guys, though. Okay, you guys keep coming. That's enough. George, you can come. We need to use you. Okay, girls. No girls? Okay. So we'll start with George here. We're going to talk about without me, you can do nothing. We're going to give George here. George here is the wealthiest man on the planet. He makes the Forbes top 100. But in God's eyes, he's just a zero. And this guy is a handsome young man. You know, he might be very good looking, but in God's eyes, without God in his life, all of his beauty and good looks is zero. And this man is very smart. He actually works for me, and he is smart. But in God's eyes, without Christ in his life, without him being in humility with Christ, all of his intellect, all of his smarts are nothing. Are you good at volleyball? Is he good at volleyball? Okay, he's good. He's athletic. But you know, in God's eyes, without Christ, it's nothing. And I don't know, are you popular? We'll just say you are for today. Oh, I was supposed to, let's see. I'll take yours. I'm going to give you smart. I don't want to give you preacher. Caleb, you're the preacher. Okay, so she could have all the intellect in the world, be very smart, but without Christ, it's zero. And I'm going to give you this last one. This represents self. This is everything else, that the root of all of these issues. It's just nothing in God's eyes. Now, take a good look at those numbers. And by the way, I saw this done somewhere else, so I won't do any plagiarism here. But what is that worth in the end? What are all these worth? Zero. Is all these great numbers still zero? The only thing that brings any value to any of this is Jesus. Jesus said, without me, you can do nothing. Take it away, and it's not worth anything. It's not worth any value without Christ. But with Christ, it's worth a lot of value. Now, George, come over here. Look at this. Just one person with Christ is worth more than all the zeros. Just one person who sees himself as a zero is worth more than all the other zeros. Now, can you come on over here? Get two brothers in the Lord that are seeing themselves as zeros before God. And it's still worth. Now, Caleb, more fellowship. And now, yep, and more fellowship. Keep coming. This is what the church is made of. When the church is made up of people who see themselves as zero before the Lord, it's made up of something very powerful. But if you take it away, you start to depend on your own will, your own intellect, your own mind, it's nothing. But with Christ, with him, we can do all things. Without him, we can do nothing. Thank you. Thank you. So what gives value to all of them? It's Jesus. Jesus in our life. Jesus in our moments. And if you're like me, I, for years, was the Sunday-only Christian. You know, it always feels great on Sunday morning. You know, you're all dressed up and you sing all the great songs. But what about Monday? What about Tuesday? Is Jesus your all? Is Jesus number one in your life? Are you just a zero before Jesus? Do you think of yourself, without him, I can do nothing? In Jeremiah, it says this, "Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom." We just saw that. "Neither let the mighty man," you know, some of you strong guys over there, don't take pride in your strength. "Let not the rich man glory in his riches, but let him that takes pride," let him that takes glory, "glory in this, that he understands and that he knows me." That's that, I am the vine, you are the branches, he that abides in me. That's that knowing Christ, the sap, the grace that runs through our life as we humble ourselves and see that without him we can do nothing. So what am I hoping for this one sermon today? The burden is that the first step to receiving God's grace that I see in the scripture is humbling ourselves. And in practical shoe leather, when you face your trial, that hardship, and your will is strong, stop and accept the situation. Stop and think God is in control. Scripture says that God ordains everything according to the counsel of his will. Do we really believe that? God, did I really believe as I sat in that plane that God was in control of all of this? Do we really believe that when we get the flat tire that God is in control? Do we really believe when you have to take out the trash that God is in control? Realize that you cannot in your own strength pass the tests. Realize that you're just a zero and you need Christ. Remember that secret to the inner Christian life. It's humility, humility, and humility. Remember that thing you wrote down, that one thing you wrote down yesterday you need help in. Is it possible? Is it possible you're not seeing yourself as a needy zero in that thing? Is it possible that you're not accepting the situations that come around in your life? Which horse are you more like? Are you the wild horse that's still saying, "No, you can't tell me what to do," or "I'm going to have my own way"? Or are you this horse that says, "Let's go to war. Let's go to battle"? Listen to this song as I close here. You all know it. But I think this songwriter encapsulated what we're talking about. He said, "Day by day and with each passing moment," you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, strength I find to meet my trials here, trusting in my Father's wise bestowment. I'm not mad because it's not going my way. I'm saying God has allowed this into my life. I've no cause for worry or for fear. I don't need to worry that I'm going to mix the plane in Phoenix and maybe not even be here to preach, because I'm trusting in my Father's wise bestowment. He whose heart is kind beyond all measure gives unto each day what he deems best. Do we believe that? That God decides what he thinks is best? Lovingly, it's part of pain and pleasure, mingling toil with peace and rest. Another verse. "Help me then, Lord, in every tribulation, so to trust thy promises, O God, that I lose not faith, sweet consolation, that's offered me within the Holy Word. Help me, Lord, when toil and trouble meeting, e'er to take it as from a Father's hand." Last year, a young man was staying with us, or might have been the year before, and he's married into our family. He went out to take my son out on a drive, and he was only a mile down the road, and he went over the line, and his car was totally smashed, and he was killed. My son was sitting right next to him. And, you know, we look at that, and we think, was this just coincidence? Why did God choose that? Why did God allow that? Help me, Lord, in every situation, e'er to take as from a Father's hand. Do we trust God in the big situations and in the little toils, in the little frustrations? One by one, the days, the moments fleeting till we reach the promised land. That verse says, "Search me, O God, and try me. Know my thoughts. See if there's anything wicked, and lead me in the way of everlasting." You know, we need to walk by grace. We need to walk by the Spirit if we're going to make it to the promised land. And this is how we can do it. We can humble ourselves in everything. So once again, may the grace of God and the peace be multiplied to each one this morning. And God bless you. Thank you for coming.